which is linked from the name political business. And the only other thing is to remind people that tomorrow we start a little early. We've got an extended first session for panel discussion. We start the benefit. And I'll hand over to Richard.
Thanks. Today we're going to tell us about probabilities and choices in many worlds.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you to you, Adrian, and others for organizing. Very nice to be here. Okay, I'm going to be in the business of choosing the anti-Eurythians of double standards. So David put it, David Albert put it in his talk. I'm going to talk about the orthodox metaphysicians and Eurythians. And so the idea is the orthodox say you guys are in trouble with probability. What I'm going to say back is you, the orthodox, aren't any better off with respect to probability. Indeed, I'm going to try and show that there's some ways in which the orthodox are worse off. So it puts in a bit of biographical context. I mean, for me, this is not an ad hoc move. It's not that I kind of work at quantum mechanics interpretation and go into Everett, and then started worrying about probability, and then thought, oh, well, this is what I'm going to say. I used to worry about probability. I only came to the quantum mechanical issues quite late. And I have a book. I have half a book in a drawer at home that I was writing 20 years ago, and I got stuck. I got to a point that I thought, no, this all doesn't work. I was thinking of orthodox metaphysics. I gave up the book, it's still there. And when I met Hegelian interpretation, I thought, it's great, that solves that problem. And so for me, I haven't written the book, but so for me, it's not an ad hoc book to say that Everett Dodson told you a few years. It's something I came to the other way around. What I'm going to say bears on this issue of subjective uncertainty. As David sees the issue, David Albert, the problem for Everettians is that they lose uncertainty, whereby uncertainty means something that constitutively requires ignorance. You're uncertain about something that you're in the future, you're ignorant about something in the future. And he says Everettians, knowledgeable Everettians, are ignorant about anything in a quantum chancy situation, so there can't be uncertainty. And he thinks that generates certain problems. Now, there's some Everettians who seem to agree with David on this thought and try and deal with these supposed problems by trying to recover ignorance uncertainty within the Everettian interpretation. In fact, the first people who did that were David Albert and Barry Lower in their view of this version of Everett. They put this next to minds to give you uncertainty about where the minds were going. And other Everettians follow their Weidman tries to show how you can be ignorant even though you're knowledgeable Everettian. And so do Simon Saunders and David Wallace. Now, if the thought here is that, well, we'll be okay if we can get the uncertainty back into Everett, because then we can tell the stories about probability that the orthodox tell, I think that's a bad idea. Now, to be fair, not all Everettians who want uncertainty want it for that reason. But if, and certainly true of some, and I've talked to Lev Weidman about this, we've got to have uncertainty, because then we'll be okay. We'll be back with ordinary thinking about probability. I think that's a bad move. What are we thinking about probability? It's something we want to steer care of because it's a mess. I'm going to be covering some of the same ground as David Wallace did a couple of days ago when he was talking about interpretations of probability within orthodox metaphysics. But I'm not going to cover it in quite that way. I'll say something about interpretation in a bit. But I want to start with some stuff that will be familiar to philosophers, but I think it's worth getting on the table, and I intend this to be stuff for the next couple of times, that is uncontentious, that will be agreed on all sides. So let's start with the distinction between subjective probabilities and objectivities. So the philosophers' subjective probabilities are quantitative psychological state, the extent to which you believe something. We talk about credences, degrees of belief. And these can be defined, operationalized in terms of dispositions to bet. Basically, what kind of odds you think it is fair to bet on some proposition. The subject of this talk yesterday explained that very nice and clear. And now, the thing to get clear is that even philosophers who aren't subjectivists, who, in the sense they don't think subjective probabilities are only probabilities, standardly are quite happy with the notion of shift probability as referred to as a kind of quantitative psychological state. But most philosophers think that's clearly not all there is to probability, there's also objective probabilities. Objective probabilities are sometimes called chances or propensities. Well, I mean, that's more restricted. Objective probabilities are real quantities in the world that would still be there even if there are no human beings or agents of any kind around. I can leave it open for the moment exactly what these real quantities out there are. They might be one-squared amplitudes, they might be long-term frequencies, but they're real things in the world. And they will be quantities and they'll satisfy the probability. Okay, so there's subjective probability, just to be brief. Objective probability is real quantities in the world. And then there's a famous connection between them, which the philosophers is familiar as the principle. And this says that I'm going to be loose, but it's a good idea to get your credences to match the objective probabilities. Given how I define credences, that's kind of the same thought as you ought to bet with the objective odds. If you're offered a bet on evens at it's a quantum coin, it's 75% heads, 35% tails, and you're offered to bet either way at evens. Well, you should bet on the heads and not the tails, because that's betting with the objective probabilities. So, the principle forges a link, a normative link, between objective probabilities and subjective ones. It says that you ought to get your subjective belief to match the objective probability. You ought to bet with the objective odds. I mean, there's issues about, I mean, what does this ought mean in case you don't know the objective odds? That's kind of details. The basic idea is you're well advised to get your piece of belief into line with the objective probability to act accordingly.
Question?
Yeah?
I mean, does an objective probability have to result from ignorance of something, or can it just be something like any squares?
I'm coming to that very quickly.
Thank you.
The slide after this.
Another question. Isn't it really two empirical things when you say model squared amplitude and long-term frequency? One is a very general empirical fact that it's long-term frequency, and another specific empirical fact that turns out quantum mechanically to correspond to it.
I haven't got to that empirical fact.
<It's both. laughs>
What I have in mind here is that we'll dispel it, maybe with some philosophical analysis, maybe some criminal investigation, that as it happens, the objective probabilities are what they are. Or maybe we'll discover something different, that they're long-term frequencies. I'm not suggesting that we'll discover both, but those are two ways you might go. You might go one way or the other. So the idea here is just to get things nice and tidy, and this is how it's set up in David Lewis's wonderful paper, Subjective Society, Subjective Chance, which he wrote, I don't know, maybe 25 years ago, and exactly the same ideas are in Hugh Miller's book, The Matter of Chance. They think of the principle as a description that fixes the reference of the term objective probability. Objective probabilities are those things, whatever they are, that you ought to match your credences to. So it's definition, given that way of understanding objective probability, that you ought to match your credences to the objective probabilities. But that yet hasn't specified what the objective probabilities are, and it's an act of a posteriori discovery, it's an empirical fact, that the objective probability so understood turn out to be maybe square amplitudes, maybe long-term frequencies, whatever. Okay. Now, modulo Jim Hartle's question, I take these things to be agreed upon all sides. I think everybody can suggest, say yes, 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 everything that's been said so far. And what's more, they should say that the non-squared amplitudes are objective probabilities because it's true that they're the numbers to which you should match your credences. We define the objective probability as whatever it is you should match your credences to. It's true that you should match your credences to the multi-square amplitudes, so it turns out multi-square amplitudes are the objective probabilities. Oh dear. Ah. The second paragraph in the brackets here is the answer to Tim's question, and I made it an extra slide because it was getting a bit jammed up. And so don't read that second paragraph, read this next. I should have wiped out the second paragraph. So, there's an issue here. Some people will be inclined to say, look, Everettians can't say everything that's been said so far, because probability means, I mean, to say that some future event has a certain objective probability implies that agents now will be ignorant about it, and if we're in a context where ignorance has disappeared, then we can't talk about probability anymore. I kind of resent people saying that. I want to resist that, but there's no big issue here. There's no big issue here. This is just an issue of terminology. It's a general situation in science. You have a term used within some theory by the old people, and then it turns out that this theory is wrong in some respect. And then we have a choice. Do we take the term to somehow be constitutively tied to the wrong bit, like electricity is a fluid, in which case we have to say afterwards there's no electricity? Or do we say, no, electricity meant a whole lot of other stuff, but they just had the false belief that it's a fluid, and then we can go on talking about electricity. Now, I think standardly in those kind of cases, the old guys never stopped to think about exactly what they meant. So, in a perfectly good sense, what they're saying was vague, or perhaps better, indeterminate. And now we've discovered that this indeterminacy matters because their theory is wrong. We have a choice about how to refine their old term, and we can go one or the other way. We can either eliminate, so to speak, and say there is no electricity, there is no probability, there are no witches. Or we can reduce and say there is electricity, there is probability. You know, they were just wrong to think electricity is good. The old guys are wrong to think that probability requires ignorance. So, the old term probability was vague. Well, to the extent that nobody ever stopped to think about whether it required ignorance. Given that, we can choose how to refine the term. We might refine it so as to detach it from the requirement of ignorance, in which case we go on talking about probabilities. Or you might feel very strongly that probability is constitutively tied by definition to ignorance, in which case you'd say we shouldn't talk about probability. But I don't mind. I mean, I'm going to talk probability, but if you really don't like it, think of me as talking weight or intensity and so on, and my claim will be that my weights and intensity can do everything for me that your probabilities do for you. One last point. Having said that, it's not true, now I think about it, that nobody ever stopped to think about whether probability required ignorance. If you go back to early David Lewis, he was quite explicit about what probability meant. It meant that quantity, whatever it is, to which you should conform your credences. Nothing about ignorance there. So if that's what probability used to mean, we've still got probabilities. But maybe David Lewis was not talking with the folk when he defined probability in that way. Sorry, there was a question.
What is this thing called probability? You can't really answer that question without addressing what is this thing called time.
I mean,
and you are in over your head.
I
couldn't agree more. At the end, I'm going to start worrying about the semantics and metaphysics of probability in orthodoxy and in Everett, and they come out very differently, partly because of the way the probability behaves with respect to time. It's quite different. So I'll touch on that at the end. Okay, so about this stuff about Vegas, there's a paper I wrote 10 years ago that probably explains what I just suggest. Okay, I said Everettians are all fine. They can say it's true that dual match are credences to the squared amplitudes and therefore squared amplitudes of probabilities. And, now, at this point, you might say, well, they can't just help themselves to the thought that this is true. Surely they've got to somehow justify the claim that you ought to match your probabilities to the squared amplitudes. And they've just kind of theft over honest toil here. They haven't done the work required to legitimate their thesis that probabilities are squared amplitudes. Well, fair enough point, but at this point we start doing the double standard issue. Let's start thinking about how orthodoxy justifies the claim that we ought to match our credences to whatever they have in mind for objective probabilities. For the moment, I'll just leave it neutral, what they have in mind. So why ought you to bet with the odds? Why ought you to go for heads when it's 75% rather than tails? That, when you ask this question, people said, what a silly question. Of course you should. But what to say? People ought to worry about this question. Everybody ought to worry about that question because it looks as it ought to have an answer, but in fact it turns out it really doesn't. So you might start thinking, well, you ought to bet with odds because you'll win. But of course you can't say that. It's not true that if you bet with odds, you win. Perfectly real situation to bet with odds and you lose. Actually comes down to tails, even though that was unlikely. Second thought, well, you might lose once, but if you bet a lot, then you'll win. No good. I mean, if it's a finite frequency, if it's a finite run, that's just a longer experiment, and you're still saying all you can say is that if you bet with the odds, you'll probably win, which isn't justifying the thing that needs to be explained. It's just restating it. Yeah? Yeah?
Why the subjective probabilities will always match the objective ones. It kicks off with saying, okay, you have this proposition which has a probability blah of being true, right? And then it ends up by concluding that your subjective probability is going to match this objective probability. But isn't that kind of circular? Because it kicks off by saying this proposition has a probability of being true, which is kind of implicitly saying that that's the real objective probability.
Yeah, the question is being taken on both sides. I mean, you're quite right. There's something being asserted by the Everettians for which there's no further justification.
And does it make any point about that argument?
Yeah, well, both sides are saying that here's some numbers, and for the orthodoxy we haven't specified yet what the numbers are, and for the Everettians the squared amplitudes, and both sides are saying you ought to match your credences to those numbers, and neither side can say anything more about why we ought to believe that. Why we
seems to be pulled out of somebody's ear.
Sure, exactly. I mean, so far the claim is just that it's the same on both sides. Now, this is where frequency issues become important. And David has in mind that there is a way of answering this question if you're one of the orthodox that you can't do if you're an Everettian. And, okay, I said in the finite long run we get to the infinite long run, can you say that you will win in the infinite long run if you bet with the odds? Well, it's not at all obvious that standard thinking about probability ensures that. I mean, it's for any N possible, indeed non-zero probable that the unlikely will happen, and so where do you get that in the infinite long run the unlikely won't happen? If you want to say somehow that you're sure to win in the infinite long run, you've got to have a frequency theory of probability. You've got to reduce probabilities to frequencies. Once you do that, then you will be able to argue that betting with the objective odds is sure to win in the eventual long run. And the point to get clear about here is that this option of reducing probabilities to frequencies is only open to the orthodox and not to the ever-engines, because the ever-engines have too many frequencies. The orthodox are talking about the one actual world frequency, and they can identify probability with that festival. Yeah?
It seems to me that to claim that you're sure to win in the infinite run is the same as saying that something which has probability zero will not happen, which is false, because this man has probability zero falling right there, but it did.
Yeah, that's how we normally think about probability. These people have a non-standard view about what you just said. They think that, look, these theories are horrible. These frequency theories are probably horrible, not least for that reason. They have to do a lot of work to explain. The problem you have in mind becomes most salient when you're an actualist frequentist. So there's two ways of doing frequency theory. One is to say, look, what we're talking about is what would happen in the hypothetical infinite long run. And we're going to identify the probability with that. That's the old-fashioned way of doing it from Mises. And the problem with that is that you're producing something pretty familiar and concrete to this ridiculous abstraction. What would happen in infinite long run? And if you think about it, this abstraction has to involve not just the intuitive idea that half of them are heads or half of them are tails, but what's more, that they come in a specific order. Because if you don't have an order, you can't take a limit. And it doesn't make any sense to say what the proportion is in the infinite long run. So let's put the von Mises hypothetical infinite frequency theories to one side. David Lewis, who later on, after writing the original paper I referred to, became very worried about how to justify the conforming of your credences to the probabilities, opted for an actualist reduction of reduction of probability to actual long-run frequency in the actual world. Just count in the actual universe how many times it comes down here. That's the probability. Okay, now he has a horrible-looking problem because the axioms of probability seem to suggest that, let's suppose that this actual long run is finite, that there's a non-zero probability that the frequency will be different from the probability. And that looks like a straight-out contradiction. But there are fiddly ways you can get around it. You can say that it's conceptually guaranteed that the probability must equal the actual long-run frequency, but it's possible that the actual long-run frequency might be different because things might have worked out differently in a different world. And look, I don't want to go into this. I think these theories have to really struggle to resist this kind of objection. It's... to be fair to Lewis, there's lots more in his account of probability than just a kind of dumb actualist frequency theory. Because he has symmetries, he has best theory, and so on. But actualist frequency is a part of it.
Well,
and
it's not a part of it that the
actual frequency. No, okay, but let's cut to the chase, right. Because I don't mind. I mean, I'm happy to grant the opposition these horrible theories.
That's not the real worry with what's going on here. The real worry is that even if we granted them this, where is the justification of conforming your degrees of belief to the probabilities? Now, if all this frequency stuff is going to help, it's got to be because you're trying, and this is how we came in, you're trying to make good the thought that if I go on betting with this policy for a long time, then for sure, not probably, but for sure, I'll win. Suppose I grant you that. Can I grant you this horrible reduction of probability to frequency? And I grant you that given that, if you go on betting in this way forever, then for sure you'll win. And why does that justify me betting like that now? What I want to know is why I should set my degrees of belief to the probabilities now. And it's no answer to be told that if you live forever, which of course I'm not going to do, then if you do that kind of thing all the time, things will work out all right in the end. In the end, I'm going to be dead. Take some guy, you know, he's a feckless fool who wants money now to buy drugs, right? And he doesn't care what happens in the future. That person should bet on the 75% chance, not a 25% chance. My name. So this whole story is kind of ending up losing track of what's trying to be justified in the first place. And look, so I just think it's all horrible. This is what I say. It's all horrible, and surely the right thing to do, and this is what many other people apart from us Everettians have done, and quite independently and before, surely the right thing to do is to say, it's a primitive fact about rationality that can't be further justified, that you should set your degrees of belief to the objective probabilities. And once you accept it's a primitive fact, then there's no motivation for all this frequency nonsense in the first place. And you can just equate the probabilities with the squared amplitudes. And that's clearly what David Lewis had in mind when he first set up this apparatus objective chance. I mean, if you're worried about, you know, it's probably something to do with frequencies, that's there in the law of large numbers. I mean, it's certainly very probable that you do things a lot of times, the frequency will approximate to the probability.
There aren't all the data. Yeah? Give us one rule. Mm-hmm. We have actual lists of outcomes from which we numerically compute frequencies. And so the whole excursion into abstract probability language is almost irrelevant to the question of where is one.
There's two issues that Everettians ultimately need to address with respect to probabilities. Everettians have to tell us something about why
we should act on the probabilities, why we should bet on the. That's one question. The other question is, how do you find out about probabilities? And David set it up. I mean, these two sides to things we do with probability. And Everettians have to explain both of them. I'm just talking about the first one. Assuming we know the probabilities, why should we set our degrees of belief? I'm going to talk at the end about, suppose we have an answer to that, does that give us an answer to the epistemological question? Okay, so all that stuff about frequency, which was just to say that both Everettians and the Orthodox really have no option but just to accept it as an unjustified basic principle of rationality that you ought to set your degrees of belief to the squared amplitudes. Now, so far everything is proposed. I think Everett's better off. I don't think especially because of the Deutsch-Wallich-Zurich proofs. I don't know what to think about this. I mean, it's a very interesting project that in the Everettian quantum mechanics, you have symmetries which aren't present within the orthodox metaphysics, and these are going to force on you the Born rule. I think it's pretty clear they aren't going to follow just from anemic assumptions, axioms of decision theory, but they may well follow from the thought that if two situations are physically exactly the same, you've got to have the same attitude to them. And I think that if we're in the business of thinking of our credences as things that ought to match something in the world, then it pretty quickly follows that if the two features of the world are just the same, you ought to have the same credence about them. So I think that might work. But what I wanted to spend a little time, and this is the problem that stopped me writing that book 20 years ago, showing you there's another way in which Everett is better off than orthodoxy, even without the Deutsch-Wallet-Zurich stuff. Go back to the point where both orthodoxy and Everett are accepting the principle with respect to the squared amplitudes as primitive. I think that if we look at that situation, there's a horrible nagging problem for orthodoxy that doesn't arise for Everett. Put it like this. Here, you're an orthodox guy, and you said, right now, I'm committing myself as a basic principle of rationality to maximize expected utility, maximize objective expected utility. That's what I'm going to do. Every time I'm faced in a chance situation, I'm going to choose an action that maximizes objective expected utility. I can say to the orthodox guy, well, that's a pretty funny thing for you to do, because you don't care about maximizing objective expected. You care about winning the money. Making the bet that 75% likely to win, it's all very well, but you don't regard that as desirable in itself. What you want is to actually get the dollar. And that's something that's detached from what you're committing yourself to do. Given that what you want to choose is the action that gives you the actual money, why are you actually selecting an action that has some other feature? You might say, well, that's a good means, but you can't explain why it's a good means. There's no non-question begging account of why maximizing expected utility is a good thing to do, given you want something else. Look, to bring out why this is a nagging question, compare an ordinary person. This is the little story I told in Oxford, but perhaps now we've got more of a context. Compare an ordinary person with the person I described as the committed gambler. The committed gambler is somebody. Think about those guys who play poker, and they're rich now, and they don't really care about winning. They just want to play well. And they spend their life going around looking for good value bets, looking for situations where, if they bet, they will have a positive objectively expected utility. And when they find such a situation and they make their bet, they're happy. That's what they're after, making good bets. They take pride in finding good bets and making them. And they think it's vulgar. Having found out you can, you put in £1 to win 10, and you've got a 1 in 4 chance of winning. That's the other bettor hasn't figured out that you've got a straight draw here, and then they think it's vulgar to really care about whether you actually make your straight. That doesn't matter. What matters is you made the right bet. Now, think about that person. You can't say to that person, why are you maximizing objective expected utility, given that what you really want is something else, the money. Because that person doesn't want the money. They just want to maximize objective expected utility. There's no nagging question about the coherence of their overall position here. They're just doing what they regard as the ultimate end when they maximize objective expected utility. Okay, you see the point. The Everettian is like the committed gambler. There's no question you can ask the Everettian, why are you maximizing objectivity, given that what you're really hoping for is something else? The Everettian, the knowledgeable Everettian, knows there isn't anything else. There isn't any further fact of the matter once you've made the right bet about whether it actually wins or not. It's both going to win 75% of reality and not win 25% of reality. And once you arrange things like that, there's no further question about whether you did the right thing. That's the problem that stopped me writing the book. And it really makes me happy that with an Everett, that problem goes away. When I wrote this up in a paper in the collection Barry Lower edited 10 years ago, and I bet nobody's ever read it. But there you are. So please go and have a look.
Okay, so I think Everett is probably better off than orthodoxy twice over. Once for the symmetry proof, and once because this horrible question goes away for Everettians. Put it like this. Both Everettians and orthodoxy, with respect to the principle, are making a primitive commitment to act in a certain way. But the orthodox seem to be making that primitive commitment in the wrong place. They committed themselves to doing something that has no value for them. was the average is at least making a definitive commitment in the right place. Okay, let me come now to the issue on the other side. How do we find out about probabilities in the first place, the data probabilities? So, well, we infer them from frequencies. In fact, I think this emphasis on frequencies is perhaps a bit of a philosophical red herring. We infer them from the observations. I mean, the most immediate observations are frequencies, but we just kind of, one observation gives us evidence about probability. We don't have frequencies. What's the logic of going from, let's suppose, the frequencies to the probabilities? Anybody who did statistics courses when they were undergraduates knows that it's not a scandal of probability. There isn't really a good answer to this. Most of us over a certain age were brought up with that horrible business of rejection reasons and significance tests and errors of type 1, errors of type 2, and it all made no sense at all. So the idea that orthodoxy is better off on that side than ever certainly is supported by the name of the test, thinking of 30 years ago, 20 years ago. Luckily, at least in the circles I'm familiar with, Bayesianism has now replaced Neyman Pearson as an account of statistical inference. So, when you learn some E, some bit of evidence, that you would have a hypothesis on learning it, is what previously was the conditional probability of the hypothesis given that evidence. You want to update according to that rule, and Bayesian gives you a bit more information about what that involves. Well, some people might say, I mean, this isn't something David Spetty said, but I mean, that only makes sense given orthodoxy. Not at all clear why anybody might think that. I mean, clearly, Everettians can apply that rule just as well as anybody else. But expect the rule, why should Everettians apply? There is a way, I mentioned, but can they justify it? Well, another kind of mini scandal. It's not quite clear how to justify Bayesian updating. There are various justifications around. There's diatonic touchbook arguments. There's reflection principles. There's a very nice justification due to David Morris and Hilary Reeves that argues that the updating rule is just a special case of utility maximization with respect to certain trends. I don't need to go into this because I don't know of any line of argument that suggests that any of our justifications are peculiar to orthodoxy, not available to Everettians. Certainly, the decision theory justification would be available to Everettians, given that what I've said so far, if you think that the Everettian starts with respect to maximizing respect to utility, is okay. Let me finish by addressing a worry which I started worrying about because I was thinking about conditionalization. I thought there is a special problem here
with Everett. In fact, I now realize this is a more general problem for Everett than anything to do with conditionalization. But let me bring it out. Look, if you do Bayesian updating, it hinges on there being some proposition E, which initially you're uncertain about, is the point in the come down heads, and later on you become certain about. So this is a proposition E that initially you have probability 0.5, 0.7, whatever, later on probability 1. Now, now we're getting onto the issue of probability and time. It's not clear for an Everettian what E can play that role. What is it that we initially think is unlikely and later becomes certain? This coin will come down heads. Well, how do we read that? This coin will have some success if it comes down heads? Well, that we were certain about beforehand. it's not clear in Everett how to find an E that starts off 0.5 and then ends at 1. Now, here's one suggestion, and it involves ignorance, that we'll deal with this. This is Simon and David Wallace's idea, and it's now coming up in BJPS, is that right? So they say in a fission situation, look, I'm going to draw this diagram. And down here, I mean, this is you who sees heads, and this is you who sees tails, and this is heady, and that person's taily. And their thought is that, well, the way to think of the metaphysics of what's going on here is that there's two kind of ordinary people, each kind of regular space-time worms, who overlap before the observation. So down here, both heady and taily are there. And their thought is, and what's more, there's two utterances. There's I'll see heads said by heady, and I'll see tails said by taily. And both of them don't know when they say that whether it's true or not. They're ignorant. And therefore, both of them should start off uncertain in the sense of ignorant about that proposition, and this is something David was worrying about, should attach 0.5. And it's not quite clear. I'm not going to press them on the attach 0.5. I don't like this way of doing it. Yeah. No, I want them both to be saying my coin will be H. There's two, well, it's quite important for you. It's the same type utterance, but different tokens. And that's the bit I don't like. Having two, what? No, sorry, a person has width. These are fact. So there's just two. So I'm quite happy. You might have worries, but to think that we should still think of people as space-time worms, and that therefore there's two people overlapping back here. What seems to me an extra step, and seems very unmotivated, is suppose that back here there are two utterances. Utterances don't last that long, even if utterances are things said by people before the split. It's head said by heavy and head said by heavy. Right. That's what they're positing, right? Anyway, I think that's too much ontology. I think there's a genuine issue here. I mean, Everettians, it's not clear what they have in mind for the E's that are going to go from some number between 0 and 1 to 1. Supposing you're going to see the head, suppose you're going to see the evidence. There'll be another branch in which it goes to 0. It's not clear what they're talking about. But while there's work for everything to do here, it's not at all obvious to me that the only way to get it right is to go for ignorance. And if you think about it, it's pretty obvious that's so, because this problem isn't a special... I mean, I started worrying about it because of conditionalization, but it's not a special problem to do with conditionalization. It was there right at the beginning. The whole thing about it, we've got to be able to say, look, this is going to come down heads. Right now, that's 0.5, and later on, it's going to be 1 for that successor and 0 for that successor. You've got to somehow have an apparatus of thinking about what you're talking about and ascribing quantities that will have this dynamics, that it goes from some number between 0 and 1. And that was built into Everett from the start. The work that needs to be done here involves a number of things. The first thing is to understand what we're talking about when we apparently talk about persisting objects within Everett. When we use words like this coin or I, what is it that you're referring to? Now, luckily, there's a huge amount of philosophical work on just this issue in a quite different tradition, in people thinking about personal identity and what we should say about situations, imaginary situations where people split within an ordinary universe, like you're beamed up, Scotty, and the machine malfunctions and there's two of you up there, or your brain's cut in two and you're transplanted into your two identical twins, your identical triplets, bodies, and then there's two of you with the same. Right. What do we say about this? And there's a lot of different options. People tend to say, "Ah, well, Parfit's done all this, and well, we can just—that's all right. So we can." Derek Parfit, in fact, has a view about what's going on in this situation that's no good for Everett. Parfit isn't actually interested in how to talk about persisting objects. He's interested in the thought that if you split, that's all fine. You should be happy about that future. However you talk about persisting objects, and the way he likes to talk about persisting objects, he supposes that the thing you refer to as me stops existing when you split. He thinks we shouldn't worry about stopping existing. As he puts it, identity is not what matters in survival. But it's implicit in that he thinks you stop existing. Now, in fact, that's bad for Everett. Because, well, I mean, there's... When I say this coin will come down heads, if you take the Parfitian line on the semantics of persisting objects, that's definitely false. Zero. Because it's going to stop existing in a second. It sure as hell isn't going to come down heads. There are other options. There's David Lewis's own view, which is like this, but only has one utterance. He doesn't think there are two utterances here. There's just one utterance, I'll see heads, and then it's indeterminate what it's referring to. That's how Lewis himself does it. There's stage theory. When I talk about what will happen to me, I'm talking about future stages that bear a certain relation to the present stage and what will happen to them. There's a theory which I think is the best theory and is very little discussed, which is due to John Perry in Can the Self Divide? And he says, okay, now I've drawn the people as having no wit. He says that when I speak here, I'm referring to this entity, all the bits that share my memories and which will be kind of bound by my intentions and which I anticipate. When this guy says me, he's referring to this entity, but not that one. And I think that works out the nicest. But we won't go into no time. I think all of those, Lewis, stage theory, Perry's theory, though not Parfit himself, allow us to give a semantics for probability statements that will get them evaluated, a semantics for statements like the coin will be 8, that will get them evaluated as between 0 and 1 before the split and 1 on the relevant branch afterwards. Now, this comes back to your... The resulting semantics, metaphysics, persisting objects, and probability statements will be very different from orthodoxy in all kinds of curious ways. But if you think, well, this is all kind of weird and different, you might stop, as people often don't, to think about the semantics and metaphysics of probability with an orthodoxy. And that's pretty horrible, too. I mean, how does it work with some future event, the coin comes down heads, and that's either true or false, depending on the one reality. And then there's this extra thing, its probability, which is supposed to be an objective feature of reality, which somehow measures the tendency, it measures how that thing stands in the competition to become real. And that quantity changes over time until you get to the relevant point, time of the event, in which case, at which point it flips to 1 or 0. And that's a pretty weird metaphysics to be committed to. In fact, if you think about it, it's just the metaphysics of standard collapse interpretations of quantum mechanics written into common sense. And if you're worried about collapse theories of quantum mechanics, you ought to worry about the orthodox metaphysics of objective chances. So, okay, I'm done. So the morals are that Everettian should understand probability in a way that detaches it from ignorance, and that when this is done, Everettians handle probability at least as well as orthodoxy and probably better. Thanks.
Way that just gets me the money. Okay.
So I'm not. So there's a position that.
The point is, you're forced.
The position that combines the Deutsch Wallis, Zurich's thought that we've got no option but to conform gives us more that's forced onto us by more basic rationality.
That's fair.
Combine that with subjective uncertainty in the sense of ignorance, as you want to. I agree that then my nasty worry won't arise. It makes me feel that the ignorance isn't doing any work.
It may not be doing any work for you, but it's certainly doing a lot of work for people who insist that you cannot make use of ordinary intellectual practices in updating credences and so forth unless you've got a conservative notion of uncertainty in place.
So, look, let's take this data that I'm astonished. I really haven't thought, and I need to think of it because there's a lot of pieces in play, whether my nagging worry will arise if we do your super delicious story about what's going on here. I'm not clear about whether.
I mean, your nagging worry will return.
Yeah.
The Deutsch Wallis representation theorem will answer. Because your nagging worry is why, if I only care that I get the money, given that, why should I maximize? The Deutsch Wallis tells you why you should maximize your expectations.
Yes, I suspect it's going to pop up at the point where I think David Albert thought it popped up. Why should these guys, with their kind of self-locating ignorance, now attach to piece of belief that match these objective wave function thingies?
Because the Deutsch Wallis tells you.
I'm going to think about this. As I said, there's a few pieces of play here, and I'm not quite sure which goes where.
David, was an emphasis on this very point or a different point?
Pretty good. It was on this point.
Okay.
I'm missing what's different here between applying the Deutsch Wallis argument to the quantum case, while it's some other decision theoretic set of axioms in the very orthodox case. Because you could just argue exactly the same way. I want the money. But I have these axioms that tell me that if I want the money, I would act irrationally, not to maximize expected utility, and therefore I do it. So it seems that this is exactly the same argument as silence. So therefore, there's really no difference here between quantum worlds and the orthodox case.
I'm not. So. Simon's argument depends on symmetries that can't be presupposed by orthodox. That's the whole way the argument works. So I'm not quite seeing why you're saying.
Can I just explain a little bit? Because what is going on here is that we have to go to one side of the bridge, you must match your predecessor's weight. The standard argument won't give you that.
No, it's not about the quantum field, but it still tells you that you have to maximize expected utility.
Sorry, if you mean the standard argument, if you think of the representation theory of state probabilities, that's a whole different business. I just skipped past that. I said that their credence is reasonably fine. Some people are uneasy, quite rightly, about, like, do we really have all these numbers in our heads and so on. And if you're worried about that, people say, well, don't worry about it. All the real reality is people make various choices, and then we can show that if people's choices, this is all at the level of subjective choices, if people's choices have certain kinds of coherence and consistency, then we can happily model what's going on by ascribing subjective probabilities and utilities. And of course, orthodoxy can do all that. The extra work is to show that helping yourself now to the notion of subjective probabilities, that those numbers should match something out there in the world. And that's what the Deutsch Wanzer group does. And the standard representation theorem is going to start.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say something on this. Can I before it? That's clarification comment on that, somewhere in Latin that might be helpful translating to the language of this meeting more. I mean, a simple way of putting it is that the things to which we attach the agents are the histories of the history space. So one finds the polyclassical dynamical stuff going on inside the history terms, so one associates the agents to those histories where the polyclassical stuff happens. That's not what I'm thinking at all, that's just a translation comment. I mean, that's where I think the concern you really have, which I kind of have as well, is the way you set it up is like you've got this predecessors and they're supposed to plug into the principle. We don't get motivation for that, so this is in orthodoxy. And in addition, we have this paradox that I want.
Right.
But there's a concern that those are not necessarily independent things to say. I mean, isn't it, given the way you define predecessors, isn't it constitutive of predecessors that we use in this way? So in a certain sense, I don't think it makes sense to say, once we have predecessors on the table, we then have a puzzle to weigh maximize it. But that's just another way of saying, I don't think predecessors.
So, once you're putting it on the table, there's no issue about maximizing subjective expected utility. That's kind of definitional agreements. Right. But there is always an issue about how I maximize objective expected.
Yeah, it's not independent principle. You've got to just case the principle, principle, you don't.
Sure. And if you believe the principle, then that will show that you should maximize because you've got no choice but to maximize means definition, but you maximize the difference. And the principle tells you that the two things will come the same.
But I agree with you that we don't think justification principles, that's in orthodoxy.
Right.
But I don't see there being an additional wording as well as on top of that.
To put it like this, within orthodoxy, there's a reason for wanting a justification for the principle, which doesn't bite with an effort. I mean, you might want a justification anyway, but within orthodoxy, there's an extra reason for wanting justification. Because it would answer this extra question. The question is extra because you can say to someone, why have you adopted this primitive commitment, given it's so detached from the things you take yourself to care about? And
I can't find it because I've read the foundation statistics.
That's the best you can do. Well, no, the best you can do is not the right answer. That's begging the question. I mean, you could adopt some other rule. I mean, you could match the frequencies to the reciprocals of the square actions or something. I mean, that's a perfectly good strategy. Something you can do. Why is that a bad thing to do? I mean, and
strategy can talk for two independent objections. An objection that the dwarf was, an objection that the principles are motivated, and an additional objection that the expecting that the maximum and the sort of comment you just made is quite a same principle that's the motivation.
It's all about principles. It's all about the physical principle being unmotivated. And the claim is, I mean, it's a rather esoteric claim that used to point, is that there's. Look, in philosophy, in life, there's some things we're going to have to accept as better, right? There's some justification can't go forever. There's some things that we will have to accept as given and not be able to justify. The thought is that within orthodoxy, you're finding bedrock in a very surprising place. You shouldn't suddenly commit yourself to doing something that's detached from your aims. Whereas within Heraclianism, you're finding bedrock in just the right place. What is appropriate for human beings is to maximize expected utility at all of the futures. I mean, that's how human beings flourish, right?
Can I take that off?
Yeah.
Sounds to me like you're saying. Yeah. So sounds like you're saying that it's not the independent words, it's actually that, look, not only is the principle unmotivated in orthodoxy, yeah. I strongly think it's silly enough, it can't be right enough, because something must be weirdly wrong. It's the wrong. It's not that we haven't got a positive argument for it, but that's the case.
It looks like the wrong kind of thing to be unmotivated. Whereas in Everett, it's not surprising that this is unmotivated. It is really where you expect rationality to bottom up.
I think my question is like an issue raised with this that will be addressed later.
Okay. Other questions? Sister, no. Nobody else can think of a question. I guess not. A question.
No. The risk of perhaps missing the point here, right? I'm wondering if there isn't a deep connection with the principle of the problem of induction, the old problem of induction.
Yeah.
Why do we act on the basis that our expectations of the future match what we know about the past? Now, surely one of the important considerations here is that if you deviate from past records, for example, you say, well, I could adopt a strategy, any strategy I like about the future, which doesn't simply rely on past frequencies and so on, these probabilistic events, every single choice you make is going to be arbitrary. There's going to be an uncountable infinity of possible ways you can do it if you don't stick to the principle of induction. And doesn't that have a resonance in your...
No, I just don't believe what you said. I mean, if I don't do A, then what was the thought? There's a million other things I could do. Well, I mean, why is that an argument for doing A? If I don't do C, there's a million other things I could do. I agree we should match our expectations to our experience, of course. But I think that just comes up raising up baking, and I think that following is a special case of utility maximization. So that comes up. I have a puzzle. Simon in his talk, and David in the long paper, both say that once you have the principle, then, of course, Bayesian visualization follows. And I was surprised when you both said that. I mean, I come to believe it follows because of the decision theory of justification that you and I read a couple of years ago. But independently of that, I don't see there's any obvious connection. Certainly for David Lewis, the principle maximizing objective speculativity and basic update were two independent constraints on rational thinking with respect to probabilities. So, induction is just Bayesian updating, and there's the question about why we should Bayesian update, but I think the attractive answer is that this is a special case of utility maximization. I think you're going to get something in.
Just a comment on that. I mean, because I was making a statement like that, it's true the way and hindrance type argument, which
right.
which depended on considerably stronger decision theory actions than David Wallace.
So, there's the justification of conditionalization done by Hillary and Dave. And that that doesn't start with preferences and so on. It takes convincing this
way. Okay.
But I take that to be a more complicated version of what Henry of England was doing. Is that not?
No.
I mean, we had that.
I was talking about Henry of England.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do think, when I started to think about pointing out. There was an issue about how to take preferences to connect them to my now in taking this bet, my way of thinking about doing it now to have this make it agree with the long run. And I wanted to suggest that there's a difference, that one of the things that's special about the representation getting degrees of belief and preferences at once out of, getting utilities and degrees of belief in a unified treatment of rational preference the way Savage does is really different from having degrees of belief just go by bets and stuff, the way philosophers usually talk about. And one of the differences is importantly relevant to this issue, because I think you'll see when you hear Wayne's talk, that if you formulate thing in Savage, you actually build in, I think, the answer to your worry. And so, or at least it's more, you restated your worry at the end in a way that made it not so obvious. And that was why I wasn't going to ask the question. I think it's important to think that most philosophers working on probability, they go into Bayesian stuff, they do it with just thinking of the bets. Mm-hmm. And I really thought all along, it's a terrible way to get at first what somebody's reasonable bar. Rafa, for example, has a quite different approach that takes objective probabilities as fundamental uses them to get at preferences. But the real thing, the more complicated thing that Savage does, is actually way more informative. And I think that it's that these differences will, I think, be seen to be illuminating to some of these issues.
I'd be surprised, for the reason that's already come up. I don't have a worry about why we should maximize subjective utility.
No, but what you take it to be to maximize it is going to be the issue.
There may be ways of understanding subjective utility.
Okay.
So it becomes puzzling why you should maximize it, but I had never been interested. I just take it to be analytic. The subjective utility just is the thing that drives your behavior. So of course it's analytic if you maximize it. The worry is all to do with why you should do things that involve objective probabilities.
Do we have time for one more?
No. How long have you been in the last? Usually we're at.
Can I try to make it short?
Sure.
This is a question that I've been bugging Simon and David Wallace and Hillary about the last couple of days. It's really puzzling me. It comes up very vividly in your talk, too, especially because you want to be agnostic about whether or not these decision theory proofs work out. I take it where it leads you to be agnostic about that is to say something like, "Well, the right way to find out what my utilities ought to be is, as it were, empirical. We do experiments and we see, we confirm that you know that the Well, I'm not sure, I guess, what it is you have in mind. It sounds like, given the equations of motion, it's still left open for you what the probabilities are. They may turn out to be, they may turn out to go with the square amplitudes. That's what seems to have happened in our world, but they could go some other way. There's no proof, a la decision theory, that they must go with the square amplitude. Is that right so far?
Yes, I'm not going to have a good answer to this, but I can see
So what's puzzling is you seem to be claiming that you can imagine two worlds. I mean, we're being physicalists here, okay? So you seem to claim that you can imagine two worlds that are physically identical, and yet in which different things are true about what the probabilities are, whatever that means. In one of those worlds,
yeah,
the probabilities
are... I'm just not sure. Look, I've taken it to be true.
Right. That
we ought to normatively match our weaknesses to the squared amplitudes. Okay? I've said this isn't definitional.
Right.
I haven't said anything
about
how one might find it out.
I see.
And I don't know what to say much. I mean, it's a normative. It's what you ought to do.
But you also have a confirmation theory here. I mean,
confirmation theory follows from the principle, which is a normative theory. So now you say, well, could there be two physically identical worlds in which these normative facts are different? Not so obvious to me. But the question is about the epistemology of a normative plane, which is taking us into an area that's not familiar to most of the people here, including me.
Okay.